Hello and welcome to episode 2.10 of Startup. I'm Andy.
Hello, I'm Ralph, and you may be able to hear our Kenyan correspondent, Susie, who is still with us.
Although significantly less energetic than she was just a few moments ago.
It's true, so she may be less quiet for us. So once again, we're here to talk about the random pop culture things that no one else talks about. Kicking off with, something watchable that Andy found. What did you find, Andy?
Oh,
the interwebs.
I didn't. Well, a few folks, Jardine and Co, were talking about it on Twitter. It's called Danger 5.
Danger 5.
Basically, it's from the guys that were behind the Italian Spider-Man YouTube stuff a few years ago, which was the parody of the sort of Mexican rip-offs of Batman and Spider-Man, obviously, and all the like. And kind of set in World War II and kind of a spoof of kind of exploitation cinema and Gerry Anderson.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it is. We have a team of agents, of which there are five.
Five of them.
He go into danger, nonetheless.
And remember, let's kill Hitler.
Indeed. The setup appears to be that Danger 5, from something that looks a bit like Treasure Island, go out on missions. The person who gives them missions is dressed in Patrick McGoohan's jacket from The Prisoner and has a bird head.
Yep.
Eagle type head, and he says you've got to go and stop the Nazis from doing various evil things, and of course you must kill Hitler while you're at it. And so adventure ensues. In the episode that Andy made me watch,
it was the first episode,
which was, funnily enough, episode one.
That stands for Hitler.
It does indeed. It introduces the concept, and in this particular episode, the evil Nazis, for they are evil. Steal the world's monuments, including the Eiffel Tower, and they're trying to get the Statue of Liberty and various other things as a special surprise organised by Goebbels for Hitler's upcoming birthday party.
Yes, the idea is to build all these monuments into a big giant super monster, giant robo set type thing.
Indeed. The way it sort of goes, it's one of those kind of shows that it's a gag a minute. Various visual gags and so on. It's kind of like a bit like the sort of Naked Gun type approach, where it's kind of surreal and not quite there, and you don't really take it literally as a drama. So Andy said that I should watch it because, you know, Nazis.
And Talking Dog.
Models,
Talking Eagle.
Models,
Eagle,
that kind of thing. And I thought it was quite awful, actually. Cerebral first.
Oh, it's quite enjoyable. I watched a couple of episodes at a time, so I got through all six fairly quickly when I watched it. It's absolutely ludicrous, as Ralph says. It's completely...
It's not based on any kind of reality. And the thing is, it is pretty much what you'd expect from Internet Memes 101. But it did actually air on, television.
In Australia.
Yes. Which surprised me, to be honest, because it does look and sound and feel very much like a sort of higher-end YouTube video that someone's copied, which is not a criticism in this respect, because you got lots of people who do interesting creative things on YouTube. I used to do very bad toy reviews, for instance, so I can't criticise anybody. And it looks like something that someone's done for a wee bit of fun, but yet somehow aired on television. And when I say that, it's because it is, in fact, atrocious. It has all the ingredients for fun, but it's just piling on one after another, and it's just shit. It's shit. You told me this would be good. You said, hey, look at this. It's got models, and it's got evil Nazis in it.
Talking Dog.
Talking dog. And the guy from The Prisoner. And see the thing is, see, a lot of these elements on their own would be quite enjoyable. But when you pile them all together, what you have is, instead of a nice quiche, you've got a blancmange. A quiche is cohesive and holds together all its multitude of parts, but a blancmange is blancmangey, and it's all squidgy and scoogey, and even though there's goodness in there, and there are certain aspects that by isolation weren't too bad, you just squeeze them together and it's just like, it's just a melange of mess. And I cannot believe this actually aired on television. Some television company actually paid money to air this pile of pish.
So you don't want to watch episode 2 then?
No, I mean, I tried to give it a reasonable go because, you know, as you say, some people that we we mutually know on the Twitter
yeah.
had been talking about it, and you know, it sounded okay. You know, the internet meme radar was beeping, but then I was told it aired on television, so I thought, okay. I did see a clip of it the other week in the pub and didn't have the sound on, and I thought, well, you know, okay, we'll give it a good go. Sat down and watched the episode there, just had a nice old beer lunch, and from minute one I just thought, this is utter, utter, utter shit.
You need to now, it's fun.
When
it was enjoyable all the way. I enjoyed it all the way through.
I mean, there are some aspects that are good. I can't criticise. I always enjoy seeing models,
yeah.
And they're deliberately lo-fi models. They're not trying to be anything other. Part of the joke is they're supposed to look like models, but for me that joke doesn't really work because the actual models in the Jerry Anderson productions were really, really good.
Yes.
And we're trying to look like real models. And the problem that that has, and a lot of spoofs of that type of thing make the mistake of, is they do deliberately modelling models and go, ha 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 ha, look, we're doing Thunderbirds. Ho ho ho, ho ho ho. And you're not, because you know what? The puppet shows of Jerry Anderson bring infinite joy, except for Joe 90. Okay? They're all good and they're played not. Straight. And if, yes, they are. Do not go there with the dismissing of the great works of Jerry
Anderson. I'm not going to dismiss them, but I'm merely going to point out that they're not all good.
The one exception is Joe 90.
No, there's another exception.
There's no other exception. I know what's on the tip of your tongue. Yeah, I'm going to jump up from my chair and scalp you about the face.
You can try, but I'm sorry. No, Captain Scarlet was brilliant.
Yes.
I even enjoyed Fireball XL5.
It's a good theme tune.
Yep. Love Stingray.
Stingray also has a good theme tune. And I can never dislike anything that has a mute puppet. Yep.
And Terrahawks.
Terrahawks is good. See, people like Terrahawks.
I love Terrahawks. We could add the toys as a kid.
Get out of Einstein. Get out of Einstein.
And Windsor Davies as Sergeant, as the leader of the Zeroids. However,
it's Jerry Anderson's great overlooked work.
But I have to say, I never, ever enjoyed Thunderbirds.
You go in a corner and you die in that corner.
I'm sorry, but Thunderbirds for me always was just deathly dull. It's like, I could give... Here's the thing, you've got all these wonderful, like, vehicles and spaceships and yes, shit.
They are wonderful.
They are, I will not take that away. But, I'm sorry, I could give two-fifths of a flying fuck about a rock slide or a fucking earthquake. Get me a proper fucking villain and don't see the Hood sitting there in his wee fucking Hood cave talking, pissing, oh, I organised this or something. Did you fuck?
The Hood is a master criminal, and the Hood pulls the strings that makes disasters happen, and that's what makes Thunderbirds work.
Bollocks.
Because sometimes it's fun and it's exciting to have all these terrible disasters, and you think, oh, terrible things are happening, how are they going to be saved? And they have to use their ingenuity, wit and style to get through it. And then every now and then the Hood, he sort of slides through the series like chilies through curries occasionally.
Get to fuck, I'd rather have the Mr. Ons.
And he gets there and he does stuff and he's got his little Hood cave. His Hood cave's bright. He's even got the Hood curtain. The Hood curtain that he walks through.
He's fucking awful. It's Thunderbird.
No, Thunderbirds. Shite. Thunderbirds is brilliant. I enjoy all the episodes. I also particularly enjoy... Actually, my favourite of the miracles was Thunderbird 5, because that was the space satellite station, and they tracked entire Earth and coordinated everything, and that was brilliant.
I love the
Thunderbird rocket was good as well, and the whole thing with the Tracy Island and the slide down shoots.
Going to be controversial here. The only fucking good thing about Thunderbird was Thunderbirds 2086. There, I fucking said it.
You take your Thunderbird 86... If you go in a hole and you die in that hole, well, we will not.
Susie disagreed with you so badly she scraped her arse on the carpet.
I think you'll find that Susie has just now retreated to her bed because she's heard the words Thunderbirds in 2086. Because you alone, my friend.
Go and stop pointing her, she thinks you're getting her out.
I'll never give you a row, Susie. You.
Don't shout and point her then. She thinks she's getting
I'm
around.
I'm pointing at you now. That's all right. The audio medium, I'm pointing at you.
No, she'll bite you.
She won't bite me, she likes me. Because Susan understands that. Thunderbirds is good. Thunderbirds 2086 is bad. And I feel she's indifferent on the opinion of Danger 5. That's why Danger 5 doesn't work. Danger 5 does not work because it's a poor spoof of something which is good.
We also forgot about, was it Four Feather Falls?
Four Feather Falls has its charms. Yeah. As the supercar.
Supercar. No, I always, supercar. Even as a kid, hated Thunderbirds. It was always a disappointment when they brought it on.
There is only one bad Thunderbirds thing, and that is the abominable live action film.
which wasn't technically a Thunderbirds film.
No, was Spy Kids 3.5. Yeah, that was genuinely bad. That really had nothing going for it at all. And we've dismissed that from the Thunderbirds canon.
Doesn't exist.
Did not exist.
But no, I honestly did, just because it was always just disaster stuff. Like, no, if I want... Is it, I'm a kid. I'm a kid. It's like, no. Had I watched it, probably, and never seen it as a kid and watched it as an adult, probably would have had a... would probably have a much higher opinion of it. But no, I wanted at that point... Problems, because I didn't see it until after I'd seen other stuff. I'd seen Captain Scarlet first, and I think Stingray first. So it's like, brilliant. Proper villains, a big fight, there's all this stuff going on. And then, sorry, I don't care about people trapped in like a mine or some pish like that.
I always care about people trapped in mines. You know why? Because I've got a great humanitarian heart. So when I see that represented via the medium of models, my heart goes out to that, and I feel for those people in that rock slide. Also, you keep going back to the rock slides, eh? What is that about rock slides? Do you just not feel pity for people that go rock climbing? You just hate people that rock climb, don't you?
I do.
It's all coming out now, isn't it? You watch a puppet thing with Natchez in it, and your dark side just comes out.
More that I just feel that they're attacking sleeping rock lords with pickaxes and crampons and all this pish. Leave them be. What have they done to you? Nothing. So bore me.
Rock lords are good. And that's why Thunderbirds is good, because it's got rock lords in disguise than rock slides.
It doesn't. If only it were, it would slightly elevate it above the tedium that it actually is. But there you go.
You're wrong, you're going to die. So obviously, back to Danger 5.
Quite a difference of opinion for the first time I think in one of these.
Danger 5, I was not impressed. I thought it was poor. And Andy apparently quite enjoyed it.
No,
and,
enjoyed it.
Susan, what do you think? Indifferent, I see. There we go. So, I think we should move on to some more pain for Andy, because I feel that Andy should be punished for making me watch nonsense. Andy, you're holding something on your hand.
I am.
What is this?
This was one of the presents I got for my recent birthday from Ralph.
A true friend.
Yeah, a true friend indeed. Now, we all know Marvel, well, they make comics, movies, other things. They also had they tried in the 80s to do a line of kid-friendly books.
Oh, that's Star Comics.
Now, before we go into the Star Comics collection, because there's a great injustice that must be addressed first.
Yes.
Now, Star Comics had a whole host of properties, which we'll get to. But the biggest kind of out of their kiddie book, other
the
than
one you've probably heard of,
except for the licensed stuff, like because He-Man, when it was under Marvel, and Thundercats were under Star Comics, unlike Transformers, a G.I. Joe, who were under the full Marvel banner.
Yes.
Although both were advertised in Star Comics, because they knew there was a crossover, but they quite clearly felt that those brands were strong enough to be in the traditional comics arena rather than sort of separated alone. So,
indeed.
But the shining point of Star Comics is Spider-Ham.
The Peter Porker, the spectacular Spider-Ham.
Yes, which was basically a piss take of Spider-Man, but with anthropomorphized pig as Spider-Man, and with other kind of... animals with it. In his first appearance, there was the Goose Rider.
That's right, the Goose Rider. And the idea is, of course, all animals, so you'd have analogues of Marvel characters. Yep. Instead of Doctor Doom, you would have Doctor Doom. And all the rest.
Yes, and now, this also has been released in the collection. Now,
it's true.
The Spider-Man collection, which I also got along with this aforementioned Star Comics collection, my birthday, which is the only reason Ralph's still breathing, is the Spider-Man got one collection.
That's right.
Star Comics has had three.
Which just goes to show that sometimes when people on the internet, people like, well, us, shout and scream that we're one thing, we don't necessarily actually go out and buy it when it's released. So when you hear the contents of this, just remember, not enough of us bought the spectacular Spider-Ham collection for it to continue, but enough people bought that there were three volumes of this release. This is volume one of the Star Comics All-Star collection. And what does the blurb on the back say?
80s All-Stars. The collection for kids of all ages not only gets 4 stars, it has 4 stars.
Oh.
Planet Terry, Wally the Wizard, Royal Roy, Top Dog. Space Opera, Arthurian Era Fantasy, Sovereign Secrets, and Canine Crime Fighting. Collected for the first time, Aliens, Demons, Ghosts, Spies, and more. And it collects the first two issues of Planet Terry, the first three issues of Top Dog, Wally the Wizard 1 and 2, and Royal Roy 1 and 2.
That sounds exciting.
It doesn't.
Now, the main reason why I was aware of Star Comics back in the day, first of all, is that the second worst backup strip in the Transformers UK comic was, of course, Planet Terry. The most terrible backup strip in Transformers UK, of course, being Spitfire and the Troubleshooters.
Oh, that's a tough call.
It's a tough call.
I don't know if you can quite.
I think I can.
I'm gonna have to leap to the defence, if only because while Spitfire and the Triple Shooters, it wasn't actively awful.
It was
just dull.
It was awful. It was.
Not compared to the Planetary.
So Planetary, which was I think one of the first backup strips, yes, which ran along with Machine Man.
It predates Machine Man.
I stand corrected.
Because that's when Marvel UK then, when they were filling it, it's when Sheila Khan was heading, and he had things like a story about Eric the Viking and some shit about submarines.
I liked him actually. But even though they were rubbish. But yes, Planetary, because generally the idea with Transformers is they'd put in strips that were sort of robot-y or spacey and thinking that was a crossover. So Planetary, and that's probably the one strip in here that those of you a certain age might be more familiar with than others. So the premise of Planetary was what exactly?
It's a little boy in a kind of space suity type thing who's searching for his parents.
Yes, and who were the creative minds responsible?
Okay, so we have Lenny Herman was the writer, Warren Kremer was the penciler, Vince Coletta was inker. So that's the first name we've recognised.
Yes.
And then lettering is Grace Kremer, mm-hmm. colouring is Peter Kremer, editor is Sid Jacobson, executive editor is Tom DeFalco, and Jim Shooter editor-in-chief at the time.
So there you go. It looks alright.
The cartooning skill is... I'm not going to call it a criticism in anything. That's the one thing is the cartooning and the storytelling and the art is actually perfectly serviceable. But apart from the fact that they've kind of made him look, the look of all the characters in this is, apart from the Wally the Wizard, who isn't quite as bad in rendition, is kind of making it look kind of like Casper Archie type thing in the way that the characters are done.
It does look very Archie like. And actually, the whole sort of line looks very Archie like.
Yeah, and it's like, well. Which, there's your first problem. If you want an Archie comic, or like a Casper or a Richie Rich or that, they already fucking exist and we're still being published.
It's almost like it's go and get them. It's a sort of Archie type for these kind of comics, eh? So moving on.
Yes. So anyway, it gets a girl robot wearing a mini skirt type thing that doesn't cover a robot crotch. And a strange hat. And she does have what looks like orange human hair, so there's a horrible story somewhere in there.
There probably is room for some sort of horrible Warren Ellis type reinvention of Planetary.
Well, to be honest, I don't even think it needs Warren
Ellis. In fact, Warren Ellis already has done it because he did a book that was called Planetary, which obviously is a play on Planetary.
Anyway. But I think there's probably some horrible fanfic in there. Anyway, strange aliens, planets, all that. Oh, it's just fucking awful. It's really fucking awful. The issue 2 of the collection ends with some woman trying to keep him on there. Despite that, she's drawn as a grown adult, and that's a child in some horrible grooming thing. Mm-hmm. The spaceship appears to have been crashed on the planet that he's on there, and it's like, gasp, and it's to be continued. And I'm sure it is in, obviously, collections 2 and 3. However, I'd like to point out already, before we go any further, I will not be fucking buying it. And should anybody attempt to buy me these... I will read them, because obviously I will present them, but when I'm done, I'll make you fucking eat them.
Now, we're going to come back to this, because you may recall that, you know, various things are said in this podcast about things we won't do that we find ourselves doing anyway. And unfortunately, Mr. Turnbull shares a strange disease-type syndrome that Mr. Burns, me in the third person, also has, which is, occasionally, if you've had a few special drinks and the wrong combination of disposable cash is available... And you find yourself going, may as well buy some shit. And you just go, why not? It's only X amount. And you go for it. Or the bit of your brain that even when you have something terrible, for instance, you feel, I've got to experience it all. And even when you know it's bad. For an example, see your last podcast when we watched the Star Wars prequels again. Even though the original experience of them had not been too complimentary.
No.
What else is in this collection?
There is Royal Roy.
Royal Roy, tell me about Royal Roy.
Royal Roy just pretty much...
He's a prince of a boy, it says.
Yes, it's basically a kind of... he's just a prince with basically looks like a ginger Richie Rich, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Several of the same creative team behind Planet Turdy. Same writer and penciler, we just have some slight changes. Instead of Vinnie Coletta on X, we've got John D'Agostino, and colouring it is Marie Severin.
Ah, there's the name.
Yep, again, as I say, the cartooning, I'm not going to fault it, it is what it is.
Yeah, it's a decent looking book.
It's just a horrible thing with there's a sinister chap who's the bodyguard of Royal Roy, looks a little bit evil. I've read it once and I really can't read it again.
Maybe you could have some sample dialogue. Just to give us a flavour of what it's like.
Okay, he does have a pet crocodile, so I'll give you the story, the first page of one of the stories in the first issue. Crocodog. And it's got him standing in the dining room, and his crocodile comes in. And it's like, Gummy, you know you're not supposed to come in here. Mom and Dad will be very upset. Sound effect of the croc on the floor, slither, slither. And next panel, he's sitting at his royal little chair, and Gummy's there like a dog, so he's patting on the head, and he goes, besides, dinner hasn't been served yet. Mom and Dad come in. Dad, the king, obviously, is like, now, Roy, you know we don't like to have Gummy begging at the table. He's like, I'm sorry, Mom and Dad. And Gummy looks a little bit worried. Oh. Cut to an establishing shot of outside in the palace. Bizarrely, I don't know why that's storytelling 101 failing, to be honest here. It's like, go outside, Gummy. I'll bring you your meal later.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Then the next panel, and the last on the page, is that the king is now putting his napkin round his neck, because obviously he's a messy burger. And the Gummy is just going out, but it's turning around and giving a dirty look. And it's like, if there's anything worse than a pet crocodile, it's a pet crocodile who thinks he's a dog. But just on the next page, the very first thing as he's leaving is he twats the king with his tail and knocks his crown off.
Excellent.
But the thing is, they've got an old butler who seems to shake a lot and look very old and depressed called Shuffles.
Mm.
These are horrible imperialist people.
They are. It's a comic, all right. See, this is one of the good things about physical comic books and trades as we move into the digital age. There's always a place for them because you really just can't buy your friends a really shit digital comic, can you?
Then there's, well, you can't even buy gifts.
It's not as good. It's not as good, though. It's not as good as handing something.
Because if I knew it was shit and I got it, it's like I wouldn't download it.
Yeah, you can delete
so
it.
So then you get into Top Dog, which also got a special as.
Which I used Marvel to own, UK, yes. Yeah. Why? Because it said Marvel UK on it. And as a child, if a comic said Marvel UK on it, the parents would be pestered, or other relatives, or.
Okay, now again, this has almost all of the same creative team, except this time it's someone called Jacqueline Rocher on inks. Basically, Top Dog is a kid, is a dog who can talk.
Cool.
That's pretty much the high concept of it. It's just the japes and scrapes involved as the kid gets it. He's got a horrible sister and pigtails. And it's just about all the stuff that gets up to. It's actually the least shit of them. It's not good, but it is noticeably the least shit.
It does have a dog in it, and dogs always make things better, I feel. So you can't really go wrong there.
Yeah. Again, cartooning's pretty much exactly the same as that. He looks like a slightly freckled and mulleted version of Royal Roy.
Mm.
So, there you go. It is
crossover potential there. I believe in a later issue he crosses over with Heathcliff.
Possibly, but not in this collection.
Yes.
Not one of
not in that collection, but I do remember an issue because I remember reading it back in the day where Heathcliff the cat turns up with Top Dog and you go on crazy, not terribly exciting adventures.
And then we round it off with Wally the Wizard.
Now, this sounds the most promising because it's got a wizard, and wizards bring joy.
The cartoon is not quite as similar to that. It's obviously meant to be like that, but. The writer-artist of it is a chap called Bob Balling, who is a slightly heavier inking stroke, so not quite. More in common with Archie than, say, Richie Rich on this one.
Right.
But, so basically...
Yeah. We've got a wizard.
Oh, okay.
Called Wally.
Right, I'm just going to read. It's like, so it goes, of all the foolish notions, and this is the first splash is a plague of locusts. It's got a castle, sort of atmospherically lit, and you've got, of all the foolish notions, in some sort of tower. And you have establishing one of the towers that then goes into, what did you say the stars are, Wally? And Wally, the ginger, centre-parted, twatted wizard, goes, the stars are but tiny holes in a large bowl which was placed over the earth. Everyone knows that, Merlin. To an old, white-haired, bearded chap, goes, Merlin, It's Marlon Wally. Never confuse me with that magic-minded fool of a younger brother. And never confuse stars with holes in a bowl. Oh, I'm sorry, Marlon. I just learned that when I was just a kid. And was to think I had my pick of apprentices.
That sounds incredible.
Oh, and again, it just goes on. And there's
so
a
unhappy.
Sort
this
of
is what you get for dismissing Thunderbirds, you know?
No, I'd already...
This is like a psychic queen that went back in time and knew you were going to say those bad things and made me buy this book for you.
So, no, you would have done it anyway. You don't need any encouragement to do shit like that.
I know, but sometimes the excuse helps.
But obviously, all we need to look at is issue one.
Mm-hmm.
So successful that, well, issue two has an almost entirely different creative team for Hulk and the Wizard. As editor of the Starline, Sid Jacobson takes over as writer, with Howard Post on pencils and John D'Agostino on ink. So, pretty much, yeah, so successful, we got him out. And to be honest, Howard Post stuff looks a little bit better.
Yeah.
It is actually probably the best art in the book.
It does look quite good, actually.
That's the best art in the book.
And it's quite a well-reproduced book. I mean,
yeah.
It's some of the better remastering you'll see, actually.
Yes.
It's really well done. A lot of effort's been put into it.
And we also have the in-house ads for each of the titles.
Yeah.
So they've already begun to talk about Planet Terry, the next superstar of the Starways. Join Terry and his friends Omnus and Robota on their incredible quest through the endless frightening galaxies. There's adventure and a wild, unpredictable humour every step of the way.
Indeed.
No, there's not. And somewhere there's a place called Cachalot with castles and crowns, dungeons and danger, riches and royalty, and a brave young prince called Royal Roy.
Don't miss it.
When I'm going to set up a fire, I know exactly where it'll fucking be. Top Dog is the talk of the town, but only me and Joey Jordan, and now you know about it. He's a walking, talking genius with an amazing secret past and a wild and hilarious future. Don't miss an issue featuring the new superstar and learn more of the secret life of Top Dog. And the magic is here. Wally the Wizard, demons, dragons, fantasy and fun. Return to the thrilling days of yore when knighthood was in flower, demons were in vogue, and an apprentice wizard named Wally conjured his way to the top. In brackets, well, at least he came close.
Good times.
How the fuck do you people buy enough of this shit that it gets three and Spider-Ham only gets one? And also, Marvel, the one horrible concession I have to make is the art on Spider-Ham is not really good.
No, it's nowhere near as good, actually, as, well, the other comics.
It's just, no.
A lot of the joy of Spider-Ham comes from the stories and the characters and the silliness
of
it. The art is passable, but it's not actually anywhere near as good as, well, Planet Terry's artwork.
No.
So, if you want to experience these comics, you can find them for Wild Buttons. Or you too can purchase the Star Comics All-Star Collection. But if you're just interested in Planet Terry, track down some early Marvel UK Transformers comics, where you can also have Endless Robot War
and
this between the same covers.
And a better story.
Indeed.
Yes, that was uncalled for.
I think you'll find it was entirely called for.
Oh, just really bad. But here we go. I'm not passing the book over Ralph, because although Ralph bought it, hasn't read it. So, in true tradition...
I think you'll find that, haven't
you?
You
didn't read
it.
Bollocks.
No! Where was it? Take it away. Let's move on to the next item.
You're now going
to... I've got no room in my bag. Moving on to another piece of reading matter. I'm sort of revisiting something we've talked about before. I have delved deep within Andy's pile of comics. And within that, of course, my eyes are immediately drawn to a shiny, shiny comic.
Yes.
This is Death's Head 2, issue 14, from Marvel UK. And it's so nice and shiny that I'm going to have to reacquire it myself. Now, this comes from the era of Death's Head that I'm only mostly familiar with through other comics and internet articles, because by the end of Marvel UK, was down to just picking up random issues and specials, because I didn't really have a lot of cash at the time and I was losing interest. So this is almost entirely new to me.
It's January 1993 is the cover date. It's issue 14, but the reason why Ralph says that we delve into something we've done before is because it also serves as issue 0 for Death's Head Gold.
Yes.
Which we talked about before with the awesomeness of Liam Sharp.
Yeah.
So
I like Death's Head 2 Gold.
So we'll do the issue 0 bit first, and then we'll do the regular issue. Death's Head 0 cover has Death's Head coming towards us, looking a bit mean and moody.
A nice shiny cover.
With the blue of his main body being dark blue, being shiny.
Yep.
And a lot a lot of heavy blacks in there, which makes the shininess stand out a little bit more.
I think the comic is a winner already.
Yep. So we go to it's the Necromachiad, the prologue, which is this is the first one written by Liam Sharp. Inks by Robin Riggs and Rodney Ramos, colour by Helen Nally, edited by Stuart Bartlett, and editor-in-chief by Paul Neary, who we technically still haven't forgiven for not giving us Transformers 333.
I am sorry, Mr. Neary, in the highly unlikely event you ever listen to this. I'm sure you're a lovely human being, and I'd like some of your ink work on comics and so on. Yeah. But for cancelling Transformers, you will forever be in the naughty steps of my mind.
It's true. Not even the fact that you gave Alan Davis his first job and allowed him to redesign Captain Britain and the like.
Yep, we're better men.
We are. Better angry man children. With an internet podcast with an audience of literally dozens. Bet you must be shitting yourself right about now.
Damn right.
Anyway, that little moment of petulant joy for systems. It opens with Deathhead in basically the middle of a character called Siphon, who actually looks and was obviously intended to be the ultimate evolution of Deathhead 2.
Yes.
It opens with him sort of, and it's a web of strands and sort of, not tentacles and stuff, but kind of, you know, the resiny stuff in Alien that held people in place.
Yeah, the sort of space spooge.
Kind of crusty duck, but this is all kind of like blue and resiny. And it's like, why are you here, child? What brings you through the spiral of probability vortices to the wilderness, the chiasmos of this universe? Deathhead 2 says, I was hoping you could tell me. Phaedra says that you are my destiny. Now, you don't know this at home, but right now, it takes every bit of willpower for me not to burst into the Lionel Richie song with the same name, just so you know. I am old, child. I do not remember you or travelling here in my distant past. Tell me of the events that brought you to me so I may ascertain your predicament and decide on a course of action. May I know your name? Name? Ah, yes. So long since I have been called a name, but it was Siphon. And then its Deathhead goes, very well, Siphon. This is my story. Now, the two panels of that have the Siphon head mm-hmm. and Deathhead 2's head, and they look very, very similar.
Ooh, yes. Connection.
So basically, recap: Deathhead being hunting somebody called Noon on a random planet, mm-hmm. and then a big explosion happens.
Hey,
Deathhead couldn't find Tuck. He's damaged quite heavily, can't make his arm work properly, and finds the person he was looking to kill, then passes out. Yeah. And the person who's looked to kill says, oh look, it's Deathhead. He's responsible for destroying our planet. And that's it. That's the four issue. Just a little four issue preview snippet.
Not too bad.
And again, bearing in mind, it's on the back of a regular issue of the comic, so it's
a little bit extra, yeah. So it's an extra cover as well, so
we flip it over, and again, it's a Liam Sharp cover of Deathhead, but this time it's just a side-on profile of his face, but with the background being shiny blue, mm-hmm. the same shiny blue as his
cover. Yeah, it's good.
Yep, very good. So we then go in. Now, this is Brain Dead Cold, and it kicks off with Tygon Liger of the Warheads and Deathhead getting in a bit of shit.
Yeah.
It's written by Dan Abnett, pencils by Salvador LaRocca, and inks by Paul Scott, letters by Perry Godbold, colour by Gary Gravatt, edited by Bartlett and Neary and editor-in-chief. We still haven't forgiven you.
No.
And it's LaRocca's very, very much a Jim Lee clone at this point.
Yes.
For those of you who've more into his work in more recent years from things like
The Iron Man book. He was at X-Men for a while as well. Yeah. He's done just about everything, really, to be honest.
But this is, he is just
Avengers.
Even for those of you that sort of caught him when he was had his brief tenure on Excalibur with Ben Rabb, where he had a cartoony style all of his own, this is where he's just basically aping Jim Lee. It's an impenetrable piece of story about robot doppelgangers and generic armoured chaps and
fighting and violence and death.
And with dark, it's just, it's dreadful, to be honest.
Yeah, because I mean, Deathhead 2 didn't have much left to run at this point. I don't think
it was another four issues of
it. Because I remember, I did like the four-issue miniseries. I thought, even though I got rid of, the Deathhead character, I liked it. I did enjoy the Deathhead 2 miniseries. When I went to the regular series, I think I bailed on a bit like issue 10. Because it just went on and on and on. And yet, strangely, I'm always fated to be by these things, but I still haven't read them all. It's actually, I think with a lot of Marvel UK stuff, including this DSA2 comic and stuff, there's probably not enough of a market to put it out in trade paperbacks, because you'd maybe sell one volume, maybe two at the most, and it would die, because there's not a huge fan base for it, and you'd only get so many sales from Curiosity.
And but also the quality of it, of a lot of Marvel UK.
Exactly why you'd only sell maybe one or two. And I think there's a gap in the market with the digital comics marketplace as it sort of explodes and takes off, where you can put stuff like this up for a reasonable price.
99 cents, 69
pence. Yeah, 69p, and you can maybe actually make a bit of money off it and sell it, and I'd probably buy it all. Because it's weird, it's like, I want to like this stuff more than I do, and there are certain aspects of the Death Side 2 character that do work quite well. Mint, I said, the original miniseries is good, I like the look of the character. Do have a weakness for Battletide, as I've mentioned on the previous podcast.
It's...
And I do think the character should come back, but yeah, ideally, this stuff, stick it up digitally and let people have a look.
We've talked about Marvel UK...
Extensively,
and we'll probably continue to talk about extensively, but the biggest problem with Marvel UK was that because the money that they made, they weren't allowed to reinvest in Marvel UK because they were an arm of Marvel US, and they were at that point a publicly traded company, meant that when they saw the success and the sales figures coming in, they then had to keep ploughing out, and they hyperextended the line, and there was variations on a theme to the point that it was redundant. Death Head 2, Death 3, Death Wreck, Death Metal,
Die Cut,
yes, just
Black Axe, which we'll get onto at some point.
Yes, the problem you have also is that a lot of the creators didn't stick around for a long time.
Yes,
in terms of the art. Now that's Liam Sharp, arguably, was probably one of the two names at that point that Marvel UK really had to bring to bear. So he stayed around for a respectable four issue mini and the first four issues, and then did some of the covers for a bit. And then obviously he did Bloodseed for the Frontier line, the very short lived kind of adult sensibilities, away from all the mistake nonsense that Marvel UK degenerated into. So did something slightly separate with that. So you couldn't hold him. Then of course Gary Erskine, who had obviously done the 18 issues of Knights of Pendragon.
Knights of Pendragon 1 is good.
Yep. Who then did the first, well, an issue and a half of Warheads.
Yeah, everyone thinks he did more than he did, but he actually didn't.
But the thing is, he really established the look of that book so brilliantly with the first issue that everybody after it didn't just, it's like, no, sorry, go and bring him back.
Yeah.
Any great artists only stuck around for a little bit because they were off elsewhere. Digitech, four issue mini. Dynamite Power then went back to 2000 AD doing quite a tenure on Slain and Dread.
So good.
So the books never held on to the artists, and they didn't really have. It really was Dan Abnett writing the book.
Yeah.
Gary Frank on Motormouth and Killpower did a fill in for Hell's Angel when it became Dark Angel. Yes. Then he was on the Hulk book.
Yeah.
So obviously, all these artists were. Once Marvel saw, and obviously for them it's a career, so they're looking at, I can stay here or I can go into the book, but I'm going to get bigger royalties and more money. Brian Hitch did some stuff.
Yeah.
So it brought a lot of careers into focus and pushed a lot of people on, so it was a really good hothouse of talent, but quite frankly, they didn't have enough of them, and some of the material looked really bad.
Yeah, but they bombed it mongs of this. I mean, even to this day, occasionally at a comic mart or on eBay, I'll come across a late year Marvel UK comic I have never heard of, or an issue of a series that I didn't know existed because I thought they'd been cancelled before then. And even to this day, a lot of the information on the late those comics, it's very sketchy. Even the internet doesn't really tell you a lot about a lot of these books. You find out about them literally by diving into the 50 pence bins of comic marts.
And your mileage may vary. I mean, there are a few places on the internet that you can find a little bit about this. I mean, the Mark Roberts is excellent. It came from Darkmoor blog, primarily on Marvel UK Comics. We'll reference it quite a bit, and we'll talk about it at length. He's talked quite a bit about Death's Head, actually, over the years, and actually Transformers as well. So a blog well worth checking out. It came from darkmoor.blogspot.com. Do highly recommend checking that out. But Dan Abnett's one of these creators that will forever blow hot and cold for me over the... I mean, in recent years, his work has been very, very consistent. but I have been exposed to him since his debut at Marvel in I think 87, 88. His excellent prose work for Games Workshop is fantastic. He's probably the Horus Heresy books, which I love. His work is hands and his head shoulders above everybody else's.
When he's on form, he's on form. And when
Guardians
he's
of the Galaxy,
he's not so good.
Guardians of the Galaxy with Andy Lanning's was brilliant. The Thanos Imperative, all that stuff.
But then when he came back to Transformers
for Heart of Darkness,
I wanted it to be good.
I wanted it to be good because everybody took great pains in kicking lumps out of the artist online. But you know what? I loved that art because it was
really European and stuff.
It was absolutely different from everything else that was out there. So you know what? I'll take that because it's just it's a 4-issue mini. Would I have liked it on the ongoing permanently?
No.
Probably not, but as a nice little flavour of something.
Something different, it was okay.
Brilliant. But the story was awful.
Yes.
So it's shiny, it's the 90s. And
yeah.
You got an advert for the X-Men home video releases.
Always exciting.
Which takes you, I think, not quite up to the end of it. Very noticeable for having the some of the Andy Wildman X-Men Adventures comic covers as their... The covers for the video sleeves.
Yeah.
But it takes you up to, I think, just before the last... So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8... I think you've got... Ooh, I think some of these videos might just have one episode on them.
Outstanding.
Bloody hell. For $10.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they'd be 10... Because the video that's got two episodes is $12.95. Fuck hell. Chiseling bastards. We've got adverts in here because about X-Men 30th anniversary with the wedding of Scott and Jean.
Yep, that looked well.
And all the X-Men holograms. But also apparently some Superman titles would be hot.
That's us.
You've got the launch of Steel and Superboy and Supergirl. Because this is just after the return of Superman after his death.
That's right.
I will say, however, the Superboy ongoing was really good. It was actually quite enjoyable. Marvel, they were pimping a little bit. Here we go. Do you want to know what entertainment this month's top 10 picks?
Was it something to do with the X-Men?
Oh, no. No.
I have no idea.
Shall we do a reverse countdown from 10 to 1 for the readers?
Yes, go for it. Yeah.
Okay.
Go.
10, X-Men 30, wedding issue. The actual wedding includes the X-Men flyer cards. Oh.
Your cards were.
Yep.
Right. Oh. I love 90s trading cards.
Do you what? This is going to be 90s. Number 9, Shadow Man Zero, The Origin. The Origin of Shadow Man, Chromium cover.
Oh, Chromium, yes.
Oh, number 8, Rune number 1, Barry Windsor Smith. With a special, order 3 or more, and they're only $1.50 each. All new monthly title, Barry Windsor Smith Art.
Excellent.
Oh, this is how 90s we are. Number 7, Punisher 88, Death. A very, very major character dies this issue. Okay, two major characters in Punisher.
Yeah. Punisher or Microchip, who will it be?
Number 6, Green Lantern 50, special, order 3 or more each, $1.95. Death of a major character, glow-in-the-dark cover.
Oh, glow-in-the-dark, good times.
Actually, there's a death of several major characters in this. I'm going to spoil it for you readers now. This is the last issue of Emerald Twilight, so this is the last of the original Hal Jordan bits. So guess what happens? He kills Kilowog, the Guardians bring back Sinestro, he kills Sinestro, he kills all the Guardians bar Gantha. Kyle Rayner gets the ring. It's very good, actually.
I see.
Probably Ralph's favourite 90s
this better not be a Gambit comic.
No. Number 5, Forceworks 1, pop-up cover. Special order 3 or more, only $2.95. New team includes Iron Man, US Agent, and more. Now,
Forceworks was good.
It has possibly the shittest art in Marvel by a chap called Tom Tenney, who I don't think did anything else other than Forceworks and seemed to vanish. Everybody grimaced. It was like a really bad version of Scott McDaniel as he was starting to ape some of the Frank Miller tropes from the Sin City stuff.
I've almost rebought Forceworks from charity shops many a time. Somehow I've always stopped myself.
No, I always buy it when I see it cheap just for that pop-up cover because I can never get the pop-up cover.
A while ago, Oxfam had the first 20 issues for a tenner and I almost bought it so many times, but it was such a heavy bundle, I didn't have room in my bag.
I can't get the pop-up cover to work without tearing the comic every time. I've never mastered that pop-up cover.
It is a difficult cover.
Number 4.
Daredevil 326, new Daredevil. A new Daredevil begins a new story, red hot. This is Daredevil with the new costume. Do you remember the grey and red one with the straight slatted bits of metal on the shoulder?
Good. Oh, that's good.
It actually wasn't that bad, but that would be just before the Idiot Root story kicked on Tree of Knowledge with DJ Chester and Scott McDaniels. It was actually quite good. Mm-hmm. Number three, Breed One, Jim Starlin art. Origin of the New Superhero by Jim Starlin. Cosmic Jim.
I know, but
it's not actually like
it's
out.
Not really good.
Oh, number two, Bloodshot Zero, Chromium cover. At last, the origin of Bloodshot, Chromium cover.
You just don't get any Chromium covers with digital, do you? It's just not good. The equivalent of a Chromium cover or glow in the dark is if when you download your comic and you click on the cover, I don't know, if the screen flashes at you or something, or you get a little jingle or a little sparkly stars go up and down the screen,
right,
or a mongoose appears and sings at you or something.
But number one, Beavis and Butthead issue one.
What? What? That's number one.
That was the
X-Men Wedding issues, number 10. Those comics have got Chromium covers, and that's bloody number one.
Yeah.
That's very 1993, isn't it?
It's totally catering for the speculators. Also, at that point, the debut, and shunted it off to the side in the tab is Bongo, because this is the first of Bartman and Radioactive Man in Simpsons 2. And for those who haven't ever read the Simpsons comics, I absolutely recommend getting the Radioactive Man mini and original mini. And you know what? The original Bongo stuff's really good.
Still,
I haven't read much later.
They're
still going.
Published. You can still get it in UK supermarkets.
Yeah,
there's still a Simpsons comic going.
Pretty.
I'm seeing a much better advert coming up, actually. I've seen it while you've been thumbing the pages.
Oh, not that one.
No, you'll know when you. There we go.
Dave's Comics.
No, that one there.
Tech World.
William Shatner's Tech World.
Trading cards.
Yeah.
A brand new adventure in the cards. 100 cards set features the characters who inhabit Tech World, the technical jargon, highly collectible Tech World comic covers, and the latest gut-wrenching Tech World saga. Look for randomly packed cards autographed by the Tech World creator William Shatner and artist Lee Sullivan.
Yeah, of course, played the fantastically named Jake Cardigan.
Yep. No purchase necessary. Seaside panel of display box for details. Odds of finding a William Shatner or Lee Sullivan autographed card is 1 to 1,728 packs. To be fair,
I've seen worse.
That's a dick move, but they're actually putting the odds in there to just so you know.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. They're actually telling you how hopeless your chances of getting the card you want.
Oh, oh. I can trump the advert. Time for some real combat, and it's advertising two games. The first one is Super Battle Tank 2. And the next one is Turn and Burn, No Fly Zone.
Oh!
It's the Gestalt!
That's true!
In all fairness, one half of the Turn and Burn Gestalt here doesn't really like flying all that very much.
It's not that I don't like flying, I don't think it's unnatural. That's all I'm saying.
So you don't like flying?
There are other motions of movement through the air which I'd prefer, like a catapult.
Yeah. So then there's an advert for NFL Quarterback Club for the Game Boy. And then there was a couple of adverts issue zero bit. And first one is Soldier of Fortune, or as we all know it, the Chaos Engine. Fantastic game for the Amiga back in the day.
I see.
And also, advert for Dracula on the Mega Drive and SNES.
Ah, was that not the video game of the Ford Coppola film?
Yes.
Ah.
Play it if you dare. If you have faced Dracula and survived, now it's your turn. Based on Columbia Pictures' blockbuster thriller, Bram Stoker's Dracula is straight for the jugular. Photorealistic graphics, camera rotation, digitised scenes from the film, and an awesome digital soundtrack on the CD version plunge you deep into cold, dark dungeons crawling with spiders and packs of bloodthirsty rats. On every platform, you'll experience thrilling gameplay and battle your way through the treacherous mountains and forests, Transylvania to Castle Dracula. Just like in the movie, evil Prince of Darkness will rise and attack as a bat, a wolf, even an old man. But whatever form Dracula takes, make no mistake, he must be stopped. Available for all Nintendo Sega platforms. I'm sorry, but quite frankly, if he turns into an old man, I think I'm going to take him. Supernatural or not.
Depends, though. If he's an old man, you'll have an old stick. He can hit you with it.
Yeah, but in all fairness.
And then maybe he can take out his teeth and throw them at you.
If I was going out hunting for a vampire, I'd probably be packing some weapons myself. So when he turns into the old man, it'd be like, aha, you've now fallen into my trap. I'm now totally going to fuck you up.
Anything's possible. So it was.
To be honest, we got
I got more joy out of the four pages of the Zero Bit and the adverts than the regular story. So that.
At least we got something.
Get it from a charity bin if you see it and you like the shiny, shiny.
Yeah.
Other than that, helping can't recommend
people out
it.
As well. So we come to the exciting climax of this particular podcast with Shits and Giggles.
Yes, this suggestion from Mr. Grufflock.
Yes, as you may need reminding, the rules of Shits and Giggles are we take two words, we type them into Google with a safe search on, and we see what random nonsense that we find.
Should you wish to participate in that, you can do it through the Stardub section of the Nerdsphere Network forum or the Stardub website itself, just by hitting up a comment on any of the posts, or hitting us up at Twitter. Ralph is at Stardubbing. I am at Andrew D. Turnbull.
So, the two words that we had, the two words we have are fire and face. Those two words have taken us to Wikipedia, to an entry actually called Fire Face, which has brought something that I do believe sounds truly unique. So it's quite a short entry about something very obscure. So I'll just read it out and then we'll get Andy's reaction as to what he thinks about it. So Fireplace, original German title, here we go, Feuergeschicht. And I apologise to any Germans because I have no idea how to pronounce that. Anyway.
And also for many of the pro-Nazi comments in several earlier podcast episodes.
So, Fireface is a play by Marius von Mayenburg, written in 1997, and first performed in 1998 at the Munich Kammerspiel. This play was a breakthrough of von Mayenburg as a new dramatist. As well as two more performances in Germany, the Kleist Theatre in Frankfurt, Oder, Deutsches Spielhaus in Hamburg, Fireface has been performed all over the world, including the Royal Court Theatre in London. It was produced during the Festival Tokyo 09 Autumn Festival in March 2009, directed by Shu Miyatsu. The play. The play is about the claustrophobic feelings of the new generation, their fear of growing up and being like their parents, and about pyromania.
Can I clarify? Is that pyromania the compulsion to set fires, or the rather excellent Def Leppard album? Because I know Nick Roach is going to be disappointed if you say one of them.
I suspect that there's no relation to Def Leppard or any of the musical works.
Bugger.
Here is the short, yet, dare I say, thrilling description of the play. Kurt and Olga are brother and sister in an incestuous relation, living in a air quotes, normal family with their parents. Kurt is totally obsessed with fire. When Olga starts a relationship with another boy, Paul, Kurt's obsession begins to become dangerous. The parents don't want to see the danger, and at the end, they are killed by Kurt. When Olga finally chooses to live with Paul, Kurt burns himself. The end. So, that is obviously a very short pieces of the play Fireface. What do you think?
I think there's a misreading there of Paul's central analysis. One of his obsession.
It's Kurt that's obsessed.
Well, Kurt, sorry. There would appear to be, obviously, yes, he does appear to get some enjoyment out of getting fire.
Yes.
But it seems to me that only steps up when he stops being able to fuck his sister.
I think the lesson here is not about fire and the fear of growing up and being like their parents. It's all about basically incest is wrong, yo.
Yeah, stop fucking family members. That shit just won't.
It's true, because when Olga says she tries to go and you know have relations with someone that she's not related to, and the brother just goes tonto, kills the parents, and then sets himself on fire. Big stream, you know. I mean, counselling's available for these sort of things. So.
True, and in all fairness, just seriously.
Do you think this sounds like a fun night out in the theatre? I've read it to you, show
no,
you.
No, it's
go away.
Not that. I want to go and see. Just, we're actually going to, it's our 10th episode. we're going to go and find more about this Marius von Mayenburg. Because quite frankly, I'm sorry, new dramatist. Fuck off. This is bollocks. It's quite obviously sensationalist pish that would allow him to get his play on screen or onto the stage. So we're going to have a look and see if he's done anything else.
Do it. Press the button.
I pressed the button. He better have fucking apologised.
Oh no!
Oh, it's not connected.
What's happening? Is the internet crapping out?
Yes.
Oh, the tension mounts as Andy plays with his phone. While he plays with his phone, I'm going to fill. So, so Fireface, it's a serious issue about fire and faces. I mean, but generally, you know, if I go down the theatre, I usually just want to see, like, the Crankies do some panto, possibly John.
I don't want to see the Crankies do anything else.
That's true. I mean, there are stories about what the Crankies get up to in their spare time, and to be honest, you know, they're welcome to it, but really don't need to know about them, you know, making the beast with two backs backstage.
Jeez, I could be sick in my mouth.
It's not a good thing. For those of you who don't know, the Crankies is a man and a woman who are married in real life, and they dress up as a schoolboy and a schoolgirl, and they have exciting adventures on stage for people of all ages. And it came out in the news a while ago that they like to get it on, shall we say, with other people. And you know what? There's nothing particularly wrong with that, not hurting anyone, but it certainly did make those of us who watched the Crankies at an early age feel slightly uncomfortable.
So we're going to have to switch to the backup iPad.
Yes, we're now switching from my iPad to Andy's iPad, because quite frankly, mine doesn't want to tell us about Marius von Mayenburg.
Could this be a preventative measure, some would say. Fuck's sake, still got the previous search from the last podcast.
Is that like the pictures of Marvel characters, yeah, and comic characters done up as ladies?
That's...
Yeah, so,
Marius von
Mayenburg. There you go. Type away there.
So it's exciting, people.
It is. This is truly podcasting at its finest. There we go. You got him?
Yep.
Right, tell us all about him.
Okay, Marius von Mayenburg was born 1972 in Munich. He's a German playwright, translator, and also instructor. In 1994, he began his studies at Hochschule der Kunst in Berlin. His first play, Hermann, was performed at Barach Deutsche Theater in Berlin in 1996. Fireface, or German Vorgeschichte, written in 1987, was his breakthrough as a dramatist. I believe I've heard that before.
Yeah.
It was performed at Kammerspiel in Munich the following year, and played at the Kleist Theatre in Frankfurt, at the Deutsche Schauspielhaus Hamburg. The Hamburg performance gained the most attention. For Fireface, Mayenburg was awarded Kleist Ford Prize for Young Dramatiker and Prize der Frankfurter Autorenruf. Fuck off, I can't pronounce that. Basically, he's done some other things as well.
Well, what I want to know about
them. There was Hermann, obviously, was his first one. Then there was Fräulein Dancer. then there was Monster Dammerung.
Mm-hmm.
And Vorgeschichte in Parasiten in 1999, Das kalte Kind in 2002, El Dorado in 2004.
I want you to know about El Dorado.
I don't have a dynamic link to it, I'm afraid. Touristat in 2005, Augenlicht in 2006, Der Habrich in 2007, and Der Hund, die Nacht und der Messer in 2008.
Is there the possibility to find out about any more of these amazing plays?
I'll copy the text of Der Hund, der...
Mm-hmm. That sounds promising. There we go.
All right, the dog can feel that sound. She's starting to lick herself.
So she has.
Making up for her silence. I'm only getting some stuff in German. However, there is a YouTube clip for it.
Oh.
It's a horror film on... I've got something in English.
Right.
Thank you, I Heart Berlin.
Yep.
Got it out, dog.
She's licking herself again. There we go. Do, 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 do,
you should get fed plenty. There's no nutritional value. Well, no, we're cleaning actually. We're cleaning here rather than.
Okay.
It's The Dog, the Knight, and the Knife. The idea of making a horror film on stage really sounds like a challenge to me. Scary movies usually only work with stunning effects and authentic atmospheres. Stunning effects? No, I think you'll find that they work with very minimal effects if you can do it right. Authentic atmospheres, absolutely. But which is something you cannot recreate so easily on stage. The Dog, the Knight and the Knife by Marius von Mayenburg at the Shelburne Inn really managed to capture this genre vividly. The scenography and atmosphere of this play is absolutely remarkable. I say remarkable because that's what they wrote in the blog.
Excellent!
It reminded me a lot of the gameplay adaptation Silent Hill. There's so many horror movies that this play is far from flawless. Learn more in the German version of this post. No! I can't understand German! I'll learn fucking less than I'll learn that! And there's some photos. There's no German version of this post. It just has some credits and that's it.
Well, we'll just wait. It looks like we'll just never know and it'll have to be a mystery for the ages.
Oh, it will torment us to our end.
Talking of torment, our torment is now over, as is yours.
Yes, for a few short weeks.
Indeed. Goodbye.
Farewell.